It's the Bungie Line. I'm Ted Hager.
Sorry, have we started? I didn't. Can you just tell me next time you start, like, springing up on me like that? I'm Alex Barnett, yes, at the Bungie Line.
Yeah. I mean, get with the program. We're in a recording studio here, and you're having Mai Tais or vodka and tonics or whatever you're drinking over there. I think I said my name is Ted Hager already, right?
And I think that that's true.
Now, you know, it's been a little while since we've had an episode, Alex.
That's right.
And the reason why we've been offline for a while is I had a pretty big glaring technical problem, not with so much the production of the show, but I had to do something.
You had to do something.
I had to do something, and that was I had to get the Bungie sound onto my mobile phone as my ringer.
Your mobile phone?
Yes, indeed. So now when somebody calls me, I get the Bungie sound.
On your mobile phone?
On my mobile phone. And you know what? Now our listeners can too. Because with this episode, we have posted the MP3 as an auxiliary link that you can get to, so you can get the Bungie sound for your own phone ringer.
Ringtone?
Yes.
It's a ringtone. It's a downloadable Bungie Line ringtone. That's what you're saying.
Well, it's actually crafted rather poorly because I didn't do anything to make it loud enough or any of those kind of things on my phone. So,
can we listen to it?
Yeah.
Can you give it a go? What's it sound like?
It sounds like this. Isn't that nice?
Well, you just waved your hand and I didn't hear anything. Did you just like post-edit that?
Yeah.
Oh, that was clever.
Yeah. That's the magic of podcasting. Coming up, it's Toby Sagarin, who wrote the O'Reilly book, Programming Collective Intelligence. He joins us to talk all about, well, what else? Programming Collective Intelligence. And here we are. We actually just did the interview, and we just finished it. We're doing the wrapper part right now, Alex. What do people have to look forward to here?
About algorithms.
Algorithms.
Algorithms. It's all very well and good having the data, but how do you extract value out of the data? So Toby talks through a couple different techniques, how they're used by different services, and we drill down into some of the lesser used techniques, but he gives us a kind of understanding of what they are and how they might be used.
And his book, Programming Collective Intelligence, we're going to link to it off of this episode, as we mentioned in the interview as well. But, you know, I have my idiot moment in this interview again. It seems every interview we have this.
That you have one?
Yeah, and I want people to find the idiot interview moment.
It's like the mistake on purpose, but it's not deliberate moment.
Yes, indeed. I somehow confuse the author of The Wealth of Nations with the author of The Protestant Ethic, or Protestant Work Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism.
Now you just told them what your mistake is and what they should be hearing about.
No, because if they don't know what I'm talking about at this point, they will be misinformed through this interview. Let's take a listen. Okay, on the phone with us, we've got Toby Sagarin. Toby, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Doing wonderful here. Hey, we wanted to talk to you about a whole bunch of things. I think Alex wants to kick off with the first question.
So you've got a New Zealand accent, is that right?
Yeah, well, it's quite faded by now because I've lived here for a while. But
where from in New Zealand?
Christchurch.
Christchurch, in the south, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
There we go. And you're now living in San Francisco?
That's right. I moved to the United States in about 1996. I moved to Boston to go to MIT.
Okay.
And lived in various places and finally ended up in San Francisco.
So what's your kind of work background and you know, a book like Programming Collective Intelligence, how does your background and what led you to writing this book?
After college, I started a biotech software company in North Carolina, and there we did a lot of data mining stuff, and I always sort of felt like other programmers didn't have a lot of exposure to this unless they'd done like serious academic stuff, and I always felt like I wanted to sort of bridge the practical with the theoretical. And after my company was sold, I was working for another company. I had a bit more free time, so I thought I'd actually try to write a book, which would, you know, attempt to do that.
What end of the biotech spectrum were you in? Was this like genomics, or was it, I mean...
It was sort of the bioinformatics side, like software for analyzing large data sets, simulating in biological systems, or early discovery. more than like clinical or marketing or anything.
And so you had just like multiple like moving parts and things that you were doing data analysis on, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, the title of your book is Programming Collective Intelligence. We get the programming part, okay, but maybe you could tell us what collective intelligence is. What is this thing that you're defining here, and why does it matter?
Well, it means a lot of things. I took some criticism for the title of the book from experts in collective intelligence, but I just use it to mean you take what a lot of different people do, and, you know, this is usually on the internet because that's where you can gather a lot of behavior, and you try to combine it in a way to produce a new conclusion. And what people do can mean anything, like what messages they write, what they buy, what they click on, what they vote on, all kinds of stuff like that. So the collective intelligence is basically collecting this information and then using some algorithmic technique to synthesize some new conclusion from it.
So what kind of examples do you have then in that area? Is there some like practical way of looking at it that we can maybe connect with? Because there's a lot of stuff out there on the internet, of course, but I'm sure you have some examples on hand.
Well, the classic examples that I introduced in my book are like Google, and the PageRank algorithm is definitely sort of a canonical example of collective intelligence, where rather than taking the content of individual pages, they decided to use what people link to as their and then build a ranking system out of this, and that takes information of what a lot of people are doing, what they're linking to, and using this to decide, you know, what pages are most important for a query. And of course, like, that made Google the most popular search engine, and everyone's now copying this concept of collecting links. Amazon is also another great example because they do recommendations based on what all their customers have bought. They can build sort of maps of what items are similar to other items and use that to make recommendations to you.
So it's really like you're talking then about wisdom of crowds type stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. All right.
So here's a question then, Toby. On the recommendations example you gave on Amazon, a lot of companies had been doing that previously, I think, but maybe not in the same way. From your perspective, what is it that stood out in terms of the way that Amazon implemented its recommendations relative to other similar services? Why do you think it's so good?
Well, I'm not actually sure. It's far better than the other ones. I think that Amazon's just a lot bigger, so that got a lot more, you know, I got a lot more publicity. And also they had, in terms of what could have made it better, the fact that they had much bigger data sets because they have far more customers. And they have a lot of products, which would be hard to find without the recommendation system, I think.
So that lends itself to the kind of richness and depth of the recommendations they're able to make.
And it's much more necessary. They found that when they test marketed this feature that it increased sales by so much that they couldn't justify ever leaving it out.
Now, got it.
That technique, though, specifically, is that collaborative filtering specifically, or is
That's
it
right.
a combination of different things?
It's typically called collaborative filtering, that's how it's. I don't know if they've made it a lot more sophisticated now.
Now, with somebody like Amazon, though, I mean, they've got a large base of people already using it. They're able to not only use this idea of collective intelligence, you know, data mining and things, but they're actually gathering the data at the same time. I mean, they've got their own reviews and things. They've got a large enough customer base out there, enough people using the system to have actually evolved a community, maybe some of their top, you know, buyers, some of their top participants and things. It seems like Amazon's a case of a self-contained collective intelligence thing. How much of your theoretics and things, and how much of the stuff you've worked with is really getting out there to maybe get data that may be existing in a place like Amazon, or connecting multiple different things out there? Is that part of the domain that you try to take on in your book?
Yeah, because, you know, most people reading the book, and me personally, we don't have a site that has millions of people using it buying things. So I do try to approach how you would collect data like this. The good news is that there are a lot of data sets out there. Netflix at the challenge, you can get this huge data set of what movies people rated. And then, you know, there was this competition to build the best collaborative built after that. And then, you know, there's a lot of projects that have released their data sets as well, but you can also automatically collect data using sort of the open APIs that are available to you as well.
How much do you know about the Netflix side of things? Because I don't know really much of what their process was on that. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you know about their process for doing it, what kind of things they did.
I don't know how the algorithm currently works. I know that a few people talked about what their approach to the next Netflix challenge was. You know what this is, right? It was the they released a huge data set and a competition to win $1 million if you could improve their recommendation system by 10%.
No, I didn't. I had no idea about that. I mean, I got on Netflix some years ago, and I actually dropped them a while back when I got TiVo. But I did know that they always did a much better job of figuring out what I like than TiVo ever did. But I didn't know that they had done a challenge like that, and I didn't know that they had exposed any of their data out there. So curious to know a little bit more about what exactly they did there and what some of their maybe not their exact algorithm, but you know, that approach of $1 million to get the best recommendation system. That's interesting.
Yeah, this has been going on for a few months now. What you had to do was make a guess at what a certain user would rate a certain movie based on what they'd rated in the past. And if you could improve the Netflix's algorithm by 10%, then you win $1 million. And so this has been ongoing. You can see the leaderboard of who is doing really well right now. And I know that a lot of the top people are doing sort of a hybrid approach where they'll try multiple different algorithms and then average them. And this is sort of a, like you might do a standard item-based collaborative filtering combined with something else, and then sort of average all the results. And the people, a lot of the top people are using these sort of hybrid approaches, and that's what's doing really well for them.
And did Netflix actually then make APIs into their data, or are they sharing the data set out, or what how do?
Oh, no, you just download it. It's just a gigantic text file.
Oh, yay. Nice.
So do you want to outline very high level then, what does collaborative filtering mean in terms of how does it work? What are the basic principles behind this, Toby?
Okay, so there are two kinds, but the most standard one is called user-based collaborative filtering. Actually, there are lots of different kinds, but this is the most basic. Say that you and I have both rated a few movies, you know, from a list of movies. It would figure out how similar we are. So if we both rated American Gangster a 5, and we both rated, I don't know, Mean Girls a 3, then it would say that, you know, based on those two ratings or based on a whole set, that we're very similar. There are various different distance metrics. But basically, if we rated everything the same, our distance would be 0.
Okay.
If we rated a few things differently, it might get bigger and bigger and bigger. So it does this with me and a bunch of other people. And then it uses how similar we are to weight ratings for new things. So it knows that you and I are very similar, and you said that you really love the movie, I don't know what's out right now.
The Little Mermaid, great one.
The Little Mermaid. Alex really loves The Little Mermaid. Alex is very similar to you, therefore you might love it too. But someone else who's also very similar to you really hated it, so maybe you'd average that, you know, between the two people or whatever it is. And I wouldn't bother to consider people who didn't really even like the same movies as me anyway.
Right, okay. And so putting all those things together, getting some of these distance vectors going on and things like that, that's what allows collaborative filtering to come about.
Right.
All right.
So we've seen collaborative filtering in the last few years becoming increasingly popular, especially, as you pointed out, there have been hits like Amazon using it, and there's a lot of now services just putting that almost as a default kind of service. Where do you think collaborative filtering isn't being used today that you think could have very good effects? I'm trying to think about different domains or different areas or different types of data sets that you think have potential.
Yeah, it's almost like it's every site that does shopping wants to already doing it, right?
Right.
And a few people have tried to build it with document or news recommendation systems. I know that the guy who built the first collaborative filter at Amazon went and started a website, sort of a personalized news website that tried to use the same techniques.
A Seattle guy called Greg, isn't it?
Well, yeah, Greg London.
That's right, okay. Findery was
site,
his website.
His site was called Findery, yeah. But eventually he shut it down.
That's right.
And I think that's somewhere where, you know, it's a lot, it's, I think it's a lot more difficult because there's just more, you know, stories, more websites, and it's harder to get people to rate them because you don't buy them, you just sort of go to them. So I think that that would be a great thing if we could do that. I would love sort of like a personalized magazine where it knew what stories I would want to read based on what I read before and what other people like me like to read, things like that. So that would be one area.
We don't really see this kind of thing on like Slashdot or Dig or anything like that yet, even though, do we?
Yeah. I mean, I think that Reddit has a recommended page, but that sort of notoriously doesn't work all that well.
Yeah.
Because there's two approaches, I think, that's going on in the news space, which is one is a variation of the notion of PageRank. So if you have a look at TechMeme, the idea behind what actually makes it to the home page is that you have these sites that are ranked in terms of the incoming links that those blogs have as a general net, and they kind of make this initial index of blogs, right? And then you have individual stories which some of these blogs then point to, and some blog posts make it to the front even though they didn't make the original population, but it's because those blogs are pointing to that post that makes it
right
to the top. Now, that's not collaborative filtering.
Nor is it personalized.
I would certainly call it collective intelligence, though.
You would?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think that sort of stuff's pretty neat, and I think maybe something that's sort of a more meta approach like that is the way to deal with this document.
Right.
Now, from another side of it, the collective intelligence that exists in sites like, say, Facebook or, say, Amazon or those kind of things, how much of that stuff are you finding is already out there that can be gathered through things like web APIs? From your research, have you seen that there's a lot of that, or is there still a lot of need for people to actually sort of bootstrap themselves, start collecting information, start mining it through page scrapes or whatever? Are you finding that there's a lot of stuff that's just readily accessible that's a wealth of information?
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff out there, definitely. Almost every new application will have some sort of API on it, or at least like throw data into an RSS feed so that it's you know, it doesn't require sort of the traditional screen scraping. The problem is that you can access this through an API, but it's still going to need to be cleaned up. Maybe you want to get stuff from multiple sites. For example, like I do a lot of stuff with blogs, like clustering blogs and stuff like that. And once you get the text, it's just a bunch of text, and that's not really a data set as such. What you have to do is figure out how you want to tokenize it, break it down into individual words or phrases or whatever. And it's not trivial because the way you would tokenize depends on exactly what your application is trying to do. So even though, you know, they've exposed these public APIs, what you were trying to do could require the data in a very different form.
How do you mean? Give us a little bit more on that, if you would. Like some of the challenge of tokenizing on that. What kind of forms are you speaking of that it might exist in already? And are there like tools for throwing out words that are just like the, you know, the obvious words, like the word the? You know, if you put that in a Google search, it'll tell you that's a pretty common word. We're just tossing that one out.
Throwing out the most common words isn't that difficult. The challenge is more like, do you want just individual words, or, you know, sometimes the phrases are important. How do I decide if I'm dealing with, like, a proper name? And different things like that. How do I detect terms that are really sort of exactly the same thing, but they've just, you know, decided to say Glaxo versus GlaxoSmithKline or whatever it is. Those are essentially the same thing. And that, yeah, like I said, that's sort of very domain-dependent. Based on what you're trying to do.
Well, maybe you can give an outline for us, Toby, about the basic principle behind evolutionary algorithms and the approaches that they take to solving problems.
So the idea with evolutionary algorithms and optimization in general is that what you're trying to do is maximize or minimize something. And it's not an easy mathematical function where you can just use, you know, analytic techniques to find the minimum. It might be a really complicated function. that you don't, you don't necessarily, you just have to try lots and lots of things to see what works best. And what a genetic algorithm does is it creates a series of solutions, and then it figures out which ones are the best and sort of allows them to breed and create new solutions. The example I use in my book actually is if you had a group of people traveling and you wanted to optimize the cost and the waiting time and all kinds of stuff like this, and, you know, I integrate with Kayak to do this, I say that, you know, I have 10 people trying to go to the same place, what flight should they take that no one has to wait around at the airport, and then the flights aren't too expensive. Stuff like that. So what you have to do there is try like hundreds of different solutions, because there are many different possible flights that every person could take. And the genetic algorithm just gives you a sort of more systematic way to do that rather than just trying them randomly.
And this is a sort of a culling of the herd kind of thing, then. You're really doing Darwinian logic on it, where you're saying, get me the one that was most fit out of this round. Now I'm going to permute a little bit. I'm going to then get the next one out of that round, correct?
That's exactly right.
All right.
But programmatically, I'm interested in how do you ensure that there's enough variety in your populations of the solutions that might come out, so that you have the kind of diversity that's going to maybe arrive at the most optimal answer. I mean, how do you avoid the situation where you come up with a very very
mundane
ordinary
answer? Yeah.
Yeah, very ordinary, uninteresting, and not very optimal initial population set.
What is your mutation kind of algorithm, I guess, is what we're talking about in that case then?
Well, there's no way you can ensure you'll find the optimal solution without checking them all. There are ways that people try to avoid getting stuck in local maxima, which is, I think, maybe what you're talking about. If you don't mutate enough, then you'll never really get very far, and maybe the real solution is somewhere very, very far away. So there are lots of approaches to that. Like, you can just start randomly while the breeding is happening. You can sort of randomly inject new members into the population that by chance might be very different and actually sort of a slightly better solution. You can also, you know, usually you'd have to toy with the mutation rate, with the crossover rate. But what that is actually you take a piece of two different solutions and you combine them to create a new solution. And that actually finds better solutions in general than just mutation.
Have you seen this applied at all in the ad serving or the keyword space? So coming at it from a visual point of view, that you might say that there are certain visuals that are going to work better than others to get a higher click-through rate. And to be able to take an evolutionary approach, optimization approach around...
Oh, I see. So what, applying it to A-B testing?
For example.
I haven't heard of this. There's actually specific methods. I can't remember what it's called. That is used to vary different attributes of A-B testing.
Mm-hmm.
You could, in theory, apply a genetic algorithm there. I have not heard of anyone doing that. I think it's like probably a worthwhile thing to try, though.
Interesting. So we've talked a little bit about the idea of collaborative filtering. We've talked a little bit about the genetic algorithms. Maybe give us a little bit more of the data problems that you see in the whole domain of collective intelligence and programming around it. What are some of the other areas of example that come up that are of high interest to people who are looking to get more, I guess, richness of this type into their programs?
One thing that I'm really fascinated by is, with the amount of social media out there, like, are there themes emerging? So there's an algorithm I've really been playing with a lot lately called non-negative matrix factorization. And what that is a feature extraction algorithm, which will, like, find groups of words or phrases that commonly occur together, but can appear in different combinations in different messages, And over time, looking at a stream of messages, you can sort of see what starts to pop out. And to me, that sort of thing is really interesting because you want to know, I would like to get an early alert on some new fashion that's going to take off, or on some drug that, like, people are starting to say, well, I had bad side effects with this. And, you know, sort of before it gets to be really big news, being able to catch that sort of thing. I think that is one area that's really fascinating to me. Another thing I've looked at is if you have, you've probably seen in Google Analytics, they have this thing where you can say where you can have your target pages and you can sort of say which ad keywords work best. And what I'm interested in is sort of building more sophisticated models of that. Like if someone becomes a subscriber, what were the characteristics of that person, of the sort of person who becomes a subscriber? Like where were they referred from? How long did they look at the site first? Which pages did they click on? Things like that.
I could definitely see the value in the kind of analysis that would be able to tell you about trends that are emerging that have not been spotted, but but do exist, and being able to identify those early on.
And there is a company called Collective Intellect that's doing that sort of stuff now.
Now, that kind of stuff, when you talk about that, you know, you're talking about comparing a lot of different things that are, you know, maybe words that appear with each other in different sequences and things like that, and just trying to start getting, your finger on a very, very faint pulse that may be emerging out. But the kind of algorithms that you're talking about when you get into that, what are these, like, really, really obscure type algorithms? And how do you approach these kind of things in your book in order to make it so that these become accessible so that people can get at these a little more easily?
Well, like I said earlier, what I really wanted to do is write a book that that I could show to anyone who, you know, didn't have a math background or didn't do AI or whatever in school, but was interested in this stuff and, you know, had a working knowledge of programming. So I think part of it is that, first of all, I give working Python code for all algorithms, which a lot of books won't do. They sort of give pseudocode or explain the technique. And then I also, you know, I've tried to put in a lot of pictures to try and illustrate how they work. All the code is explained very in small blocks, and it sort of builds up slowly so you can see what each piece is doing. I think I succeeded. I know that a lot of people have emailed me and told me that that was the clearest explanation of, you know, k-means clustering I've ever seen.
Yeah, I saw several of the reviews, actually. I think I looked through some of them both on O'Reilly and on Amazon, and people were saying, you know, actually this guy manages to make algorithms understandable. So kudos to you on that.
Thank you.
The thing that I wonder about that is, when you put the Python code, actually working Python code in, that's really cool because people don't have to deal with pseudocode and that kind of stuff. They can, if they're Python programmers, they can use it directly. And I understand Python's pretty easy to get to grok and then move into whatever code that you want, you know, porting the ideas on it. How much of how is this stuff that's in the book when it comes to your code snippets? Is this stuff stuff that somebody can just lift right out of it? Like, is it under Creative Commons or anything like that? For the algorithms themselves, I mean.
I actually don't know what O'Reilly's copyright policy is. I think that you're, you know, obviously allowed to use the code in your programs. I think that republishing it, you're supposed to ask them for permission. I honestly don't know. I also posted all the code downloadable for free on my website.
Well, okay, there, that answers it.
So, because, you know, people didn't want to type it in from the book every time if they just wanted to run it.
Yeah, yeah. Nice.
I wanted to ask, do you remember, Toby, I think it was on the BBC where they had done an analysis of blog posts over a period of time. And what they were trying to understand was the overall happiness versus sadness factor. And they were looking at a kind of before, during, and after the tsunami. over in Asia.
Ah.
And they were able to show through the text that people were using about, you know, how they felt literally. And then out of that extracted a barometer, essentially, on the world's level of happiness or the world's level of sadness or anger or various different emotions. And I don't think that's a money-making exercise, but do you see that given the larger number of data sets that are available and the availability of things like the algorithms that you provide, that that we're going to be seeing more and more interesting use and tools and visualizations of data that just weren't possible a few years ago?
Yeah, definitely. I know that in terms of what you just described, that there are companies that will do sentiment indication, like about a particular company right now, right? Like they'll graph how much people like Apple right now based on a very similar approach to the tsunami thing. And, you know, I'm sure that if you looked at blog posts about Facebook in the last month, you would see a lot of positive sentiment turning negative because of Beacon and stuff like that. So I think like that sort of analysis is great because, yeah, you really couldn't have done that before so easily. You know, a lot of these marketing firms, they did this by interviewing random people or calling them on the phone. Now you actually have people just posting their thoughts all the time. Of course, it is heavily biased, which you have to be careful of, right? It's only people who are bloggers are a particular kind of person. It's same with probably any sort of collective intelligence thing you find on the site. It's like Wikipedia will have as much on the Battlestar Galactica episodes as they will on the history of Spain. And obviously that, you know, is because the audience is extremely biased to be like tech-savvy men.
Yeah, your sample community that you're getting the data from is already slanted toward people who have computers, who have that kind of wealth, probably are living in first world countries for the most part, and many
right.
other, and many other
your,
factors.
If that's your target market, which it is for technology products, then that's probably okay, right?
Right.
If you're trying to like understand what those people want.
You know, it raises another question, though, in the whole data mining idea. If you've got all this data out there and you're not just going to sites that are like Amazon where they have reviews and things like that, but you're starting to do things like mining data that might just be public domain information or blogs or those kind of things. I guess the best way I've heard it said, and this is sort of stealing from an O'Reilly question from your O'Reilly interview, but I mean, we do reveal our sources, and thanks, O'Reilly, for interviewing you and giving us a little bit of a primer there. But I've heard it said regarding that old saw about putting enough monkeys at enough typewriters, you know, that eventually you would get the complete works of Shakespeare out of one of them. And there's a lot of different mutations. And then, there's this other... I guess somebody else was some real smart person and smart ass person actually stated it this way. Well, we now know that that's actually not true. You can't get the complete works of Shakespeare just by random typing out there. We've tried this experiment. It's called the internet. What I'm saying is there's a lot of junk out there on the net that you have to get through. You know, you got spam, eggs, sausages, and spam out there. And how do you get through all that kind of stuff when you're doing this kind of stuff? What kind of filtering techniques do you have to do, or what kind of considerations are involved in that?
Yeah, I mean, that's like a huge question, right? It's
you mean the number of words I use to get the question out, or do you mean it's a huge question as far as the answer goes?
The implications of it. You know, any algorithm that you design that's successful, you know, will attract people trying to manipulate it. If someone finds out that you're using, you know, Google has to deal with people trying to manipulate PageRank with their link farms and everything. And then I'm sure if you came up with some great marketing algorithm that was going to be cool based on blogs, someone would start seeding blogs with whatever your algorithm looks for. And you know, the important consideration there, especially with spam, is that people are more creative than your algorithm. Whatever you've come up with, you know, thinking of ways to destroy, to defeat it, and basically you can never design a spam filter that you can just run and never worry about again. You have to figure out what people are trying to do to defeat it and come up with countermeasures for that. So, yeah, there's a lot of junk, but, I mean, I think you can see from Gmail, I don't know, I publish my email address online in a lot of places. So I get probably 50 real emails and 1,000 spam messages a day. And I probably only see one or two of the spam messages. And I see all the real emails. So it's working, whatever they're doing, pretty well for me at least.
In your book, Toby, well, the title of it, specifically Collective Intelligence, I think that there is this kind of science fiction use of that term. You know, we talk about the Borg or the kind of the internet that becomes alive and thinks for itself and all the rest of it. But a recent book, Wisdom of the Crowds, did speak to a kind of a statistical, if you like, tipping point that occurs when you get a large number of people discussing or making decisions that you are more likely actually to make a better decision collectively.
I think that I read that book. I really liked it. But his conclusion was essentially that there are certain ways in which crowds can be wise. Mm-hmm. And part of it is very important that they are acting independently and having their opinions aggregated rather than sitting around discussing something, because that's more likely to make them stupid.
Through communication, they will be more likely to become stupid.
Well, they'll be more likely to sort of generate this mob mentality, right? Like you see with market bubbles or whatever.
So it's the difference between the phrase that a camel is a horse designed by committee versus the idea of maybe the Max Weber's invisible hand can guide the market just through a bunch of people working in their own individual self-interest.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Really?
I think you see like financial manias, not because everyone suddenly independently decides that dot-com stocks are a great investment, so much as a few people decide that and tell everyone else.
Yeah, now that's an interesting point, Toby. So one of the biggest users of algorithms are, you know, the markets, financial markets, who are doing a massive amount of work around being able to arrive at the right conclusion around a particular stock price or a particular commodity at X period down the time or down the road. How do those guys factor in the human element, the what you've just described there? How can they factor it out, or how can they factor it in? I mean, will they ever get there?
No, I can't imagine. I honestly don't know. I mean, I know they. I know that a lot of these quant funds make a lot of money. I don't really know how they do it. I think that this, you just sort of look for like patterns that occur, and maybe not even really understand why they're happening. Hmm. But as long as they're persistent, then you can make money from that, right? Like you know that that in simple cases, like if a stock goes up under these circumstances, then we'll buy it under those circumstances. They don't really understand what decisions people are making that's causing that to happen.
Yeah, and you can't account for. I think it's the herd mentality that something flips, a bit of news out there goes, and it propagates through the media, and affects the collective consciousness at a level.
Right.
And it off goes, and there's no rationality behind it. There's no reason for it, but enough people decide to go, and a market collapses or it booms on nothing more than irrationality.
Right, and so I think that, you know, for collective intelligence to really work, there needs to be this sort of diversity of opinion where it's not people who are just talking to each other or making a combined decision as much as you figure out ways to aggregate aggregate the ideas of distinct people who maybe don't even know each other.
So, Toby, in your book, you get through a lot of different stuff. We know we're just sort of touching on the edge of a lot of different things. I mean, the list online that describes your book talks about not just collaborative filtering, but also group detection, different ways of clustering things together. It talks about search engines. It talks about Bayesian filtering. It talks about decision trees in different ways. It talks about support vector machines, all kinds of different things. Online dating, I think it gets into how some of that vectoring works. How do people get a hold of your book if they want to flip through this thing? What's the best method? Go to Amazon? Go to O'Reilly? Is there a way that you prefer?
It's on Amazon. That's probably the best way, sort of cheapest. And then there's, you know, it's on the Safari. If you have an O'Reilly subscription, you can read it online. You know, if you're into that sort of thing, you can probably also get it on BitTorrent.
Okay. So your financial interest in this and O'Reilly's financial interest to this, you've just surrendered. Is that correct?
I mean, everyone knows it, right?
Yeah.
When it appeared there, I was actually wondering if that was going to make my sales better or worse.
Well, hopefully it improves them. If you have downloaded this on BitTorrent, we'll tell our listeners to please send money directly to Toby Segarin.
I actually met someone who told me that he downloaded his copy on BitTorrent, read the whole thing, and liked it.
He actually sent you a message.
Wait, what's your commission per book sale? And I said, it's about $1 or $2.
Oh, wow.
So he gave me $2.
That's nice of him. So we will link to your book off of our website. That will go right off to Amazon there. And that way we also put our own seller ID so we can keep the podcast going. So buy it through our site too.
buy it through this site.
and we'll also link off to your blog and everything else, Toby. And with that, we say thank you very much for spending a little time with us on the Bungie Line.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks, Toby.
And that's a wrap for our talk with Toby Segarin. Alex, it was Adam Smith.
Oh, not Max Weber.
Not Max Weber at all. Yeah. And after saying that and, you know, sitting through the rest of the interview, if I seem checked out after I mention that part in that part of the interview where I'm just no longer sharp, well, okay, I wasn't sharp to begin with, but if I become more blunted than I already was, that's why I was sitting there going, did you just say Max Weber? You inadequate name dropper, you. So anyway, do you have any cool web thing this week?
I can think of cool stuff that happened a while ago, and I can think of things that happened recently that aren't cool, but that combination of cool and recent, I'm not there today.
You know, probably after we're finished recording this, we'll go back to our desks, we'll find the cool web thing that we should have talked about, and the show will already come out, and people will think, these two clowns, they never find the cool stuff. But here's my cool web thing. It has to do with webbed feet. I don't know if you saw last week, but Wired actually ran an article on this. That's how I picked it up. But a Hadrosaurus was actually found, unearthed, and this Hadrosaurus was apparently, this is one of these, what they call the duck-billed dinosaurs. They figure they were swamp-dwelling. They were two-legged, stood up most of the time. Of course, they had little arm-like legs up in the front. But
so when it looks like a giant duck.
Yeah, exactly. Well, only more like a dinosaur. So the Hadrosaurus that they found was mummified. That is, it was buried so quickly and in such an anaerobic environment that it never decomposed correctly and the skin mineralized. So they actually have now one of the most complete Hadrosauruses they've ever found. There's a couple other mummified dinosaurs. There was a Trachodon some years, like 20, 30 years ago, that they found. But a Hadrosaurus was found, and it has, of course, webbed feet. Or at least I'm making that part up, I think, just so it's relevant to this, because I think that's kind of cool.
I can see the connection between internet cool stuff that happened recently and a dinosaur that looks like a duck that was mummified.
I'm glad that you can. That's it for this episode of the Bungie Line. We'll see you next time, and we'll link to the Hadrosaurus article. Thanks a lot.